You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. That was a very strange-sounding version of the song I played at the beginning of my show. Something was wrong there. We will have to look into that. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with short fiction writer Megan Mayhew Bergman, who was raised in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and now lives on a small farm in Shaftesbury, Vermont. Megan Mayhew Bergman graduated from Wake Forest University and completed graduate degrees at Duke University and Bennington College. She was a fiction scholar at Breadloaf and received a fellowship from the Millay Colony for the Arts in November 2007. Her work has twice been nominated for the Pushcart Prize and has appeared in the New York Times, Best American Short Stories 2011, New Stories from the South 2010, Oxford American, Narrative, Plowshares, One Story, and Elsewhere. She lives with her veterinarian husband, Beau, two daughters, four dogs, four cats, two goats, a horse, and a handful of chickens. In November 2010, Megan was elected Justice of the Peace for the town of Shaftesbury. She also teaches literature at Bennington College. Scribner published her first story collection, Birds of a Lesser Paradise, in March. When I interviewed her, I began by asking her about repeating images in her fiction. For example, one of her stories, Housewifely Arts, features a talking bird that imitates voices and sounds that he hears. And later in that story, we learn that the protagonist's child also does some imitations. And even farther into the story, we learn that the mother occasionally used to do imitations. Another example I mentioned when I spoke to her had to do with the inclusion of crickets in that same story. And then a reference later in the story to the protagonist's childhood house and its exoskeleton, which of course recalls the image of crickets, which without actually naming them. So I asked her to start by talking about these repeating images.
Oftentimes they're, I think a little, I won't say something different than accidental, but I guess maybe subconscious, often. The one that my editor actually had to keep editing out, I kept putting my one-eyed cat in every story. We had three instances of a one-eyed cat, and she said, you know, we can only keep one of these, so that one had to go. But I'm glad you brought up the exoskeleton. I do love that one so much, just this idea of what we discard and what we keep with us and what's important. And just I think our culture's strange relationship with permanence and material things is different than the way it used to be. I think generations before us owned objects or built houses with permanence in mind, and I'm not sure that we do anymore. And that was definitely a part of the story.
Okay, great. So that's very interesting. So apart from the crickets, that had its own meaning for you. And it sounds like it arose sort of organically and not because you were trying to put in another image that would remind us of, for example, crickets.
Yeah. I've been told that symbolism happens best organically and on its own, that most writers have their obsessions and their quirks and the things that are already planted in their brain and in the story, and those things will show up. If you orchestrate too hard, the reader can see the sort of seams of your work. So
right.
Most of them are organic, I think.
And it's a pleasure to discover them, and none of these felt forced at all. I was just curious. Like, there's another instance in the story, Saving Face. Your protagonist, Lila, has a disfiguring injury over her lip from a bite. She's, in this case, the vet. And later in that story, a character is being very kind to a horse and strokes the horse's lip and gum line, and the horse, you know, reacts with pleasure. And I thought, you know, this is a lovely sort of resonant moment where we kind of feel just his kindness toward the animals and also her need to be whole again. I don't know. So that's another example. I just wondered if you remember doing that one.
You know, I always love hearing people talk about my work because for a moment sometimes I forget I'm the writer, and I was just listening with pleasure to you describe that. Thank you. Thank you for seeing it. And yes, I mean, I thought so much about that gesture being sort of a signifier of compassion. I mean, Romulus is the character you're talking about that is stroking the horse's mouth, he's living on a working prison farm. And so we have mixed emotions about him as we approach him as a reader. And I was thinking about sort of a gesture of compassion, which compassion ends up being a sort of theme of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
definitely. Now, you've just mentioned Romulus, so that kind of jumps me over to another question that's a little bit different. But talk about naming characters. I love his name, Romulus Candle. And in another story, you have a Smith Jones, which is a great name. So can you talk a little bit about how you come up with your character names?
Yes. Southern people have a great naming tradition. And I grew up in North Carolina, and that's where I lived for 30 years. And occasionally I had this really morbid habit of reading the obituaries, and I was always, I think, looking for names. That's a terrible writerly habit, but it's what, you know, I think we're always hunting and gathering, mm-hmm. As writers, and that's one of the things that I was doing. And a lot of Southern friends I know use, especially women, before more women were really using or keeping their names, I noticed a lot of my friends were named with their mother's maiden names or family names. And so that sort of naming convention, I like unusual names. I like the idea of a name being big enough to grow into. My girls have strange names, my own daughters. They're Fraser and Zephyr. And my father says it sounds like Jerry Garcia has named our children, which it does, I guess. But, I had a next-door neighbor named Atticus Rex, and he was this wonderful intellectual boy and very kind, but he had this fierce name. But I love what names can do for a character, those little sort of notes of personality that they add.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think if you name somebody Atticus, you're sort of demanding that they become intellectual and kind, aren't you? I mean,
right, yes, yeah. But I love names. I love what they can give a character, and I was thinking about that when I was, you know, naming the people in my stories and also my own children, just something to grow into, something to fill out.
Yeah, yeah, great. Well, you mentioned that you're from the South, and I was curious, sort of almost on a personal level, what it's like living in the Southern. I assume maybe you were from the country. Maybe I'm reading too much into your story about living in the swamp, but were you in the country in the South?
I grew up in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which is a little tobacco town off 95 in eastern North Carolina. And we didn't live on a farm, but we lived on a house with, you know, about 1 acre of land. And my parents had grown up in rural Virginia, and, you know, my mother's family had a family farm that we visited. And my parents, I think, were not as interested. I think they were moving in the opposite direction away from their agricultural heritage, and I think they've always been surprised that I'm always trying my best to move toward it. So now in Vermont, we live on a small farm with a lot of barn animals and rescue dogs and everything we can pile in here.
So the second half of my question was, how is it to move north, having grown up in the South and living, you know, maybe with exposure to the countryside and farming, and now you live in the northern countryside?
Yeah, it was very good for my work. I feel that moving 12 hours north away from anything I've ever known or people I've ever known is really freeing as an artist. I felt like I could write the way I really wanted to write. I could look back at the South with a little bit more distance perspective and clarity. So all that was all very healthy. And I also really wanted proximity to the natural world. It's something I've always craved, even as a child. And, you know, as you come into adulthood and get to control your own destiny a little bit, it's always been the thing that I was moving toward. And by moving to Vermont, I was able to really build that life for myself with my husband, who's a veterinarian. And we live on his, the house that he, we live in the house he grew up in. It's an old farmhouse from the 1800s on some acreage. And it's lovely, and it's brought me close to the things that I want to write about.
I want to ask you, this is maybe a very general question, but I really admire the shape of your stories. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about beginnings, middles, and endings. When you're writing, do you just sort of sit down and write and it all sort of comes out? Or are you thinking very intensely about how to begin a story and how to keep going? Or is that all something that happens more in revision for you?
Yeah, those are good questions. And it varies per story, but generally my process is this. I think on a story for a long time, and I teach at Bennington College, and this is something I've been talking about my students about, is just give yourself that thought time, that so that your quality of idea is high. you know, really let things sit for a while. And so I'm usually thinking of a story at night before I go to bed and when I'm on a long run, and these things are sort of, and it starts to take a sort of shape, and I can work through it a little. And so when I sit down to the page, I know a little bit more about the story because it's been living in my mind and my imagination for a while, and I've been thinking about the characters and trying to make them as full and real as I can in my mind. So I really like the idea of thinking time with a story. I've had stories that I've been thinking about for years that I haven't written yet, and I can't wait to write, and it gives me that a certain sort of energy when I come to the page. I'm excited to finally get it out and work on it.
Do you find yourself kind of holding off on getting started too soon and making yourself wait in order to kind of build that excitement?
Sometimes I do, yeah. I really, especially, and I think we all have these stories, and maybe they're called darlings if we hold on to them too much, but I think we all have these one or two stories that we know we have to write, and we have to write well, and we have to do them justice. And I definitely have a few of those that I've still been holding on to until I feel like I can really, I either have the perspective or the imaginative quality or the time or the writing skills to pull off. So I do have a few that I'm just really savoring and thinking about. And I will be excited to write them when the time comes. It's also a bit of a time management technique, I think, for me as a working mom, that I do a lot of work in my head.
Yeah.
I don't actually have all that much page time.
Okay.
And when I'm thinking about beginnings, I read, I think it was by Jonathan Safran Foer, an interview where he said something about starting a story should be like jumping on a treadmill. The reader should be engaged right away. And that's one of the things I'm always thinking about when I want the reader to feel intrigued and I want them to feel swept up. And I think one of the mistakes beginning writers make early on, and that I used to make myself, is a lot of wind up. Is telling the reader things you think you want them to know. You know, maybe it's too much about the weather, but what the reader's really looking for is where to invest emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so philosophically, I try to keep those things in mind when I'm beginning a story. The middle of the story, for me, the question always is, am I making promises that I'm going to keep? Am I being selective about the anecdotes that I'm sharing? And am I keeping narrative energy? You know, because I've often found that when I read a piece out loud, that's when I can tell if the piece has died in some way, I'm checking out of my own work, or I can feel the audience shift a little. It's, you know, it's something to think about. And I think, you know, not everything should be high impact, because that would be screaming at a reader. You know, you definitely want the slopes and the balance. But that's something I think about with the middle. And then with the end, I just attended a great talk by Rebecca Mackay. We were visiting writers at Franklin and Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave a lecture on endings, and she was talking about how an ending is really, you shift from writing prose into writing poetry, that you slow it down, and that often as writers we have this ending in mind and we really want to get to it, but the reader slows down with you at the end, and they're looking for things to savor, and they're looking for cues. And so I've been telling myself that recently, just don't be afraid to slow it down and get the musicality of the ending right.
And then when you are sort of maybe enthusiastically writing toward a certain ending that you've envisioned, do you ever find that it's not the ending that it's going to be, and that you have to kind of let go of that and go a different way?
Almost every time.
Oh, really?
I do have a few last lines that have come to me that I felt that I knew were right, but those are usually after I'd already pictured one ending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, great. This is not really a fully fledged question, but it just totally cracked me up. You have a line in the book. This woman and her husband go to the birthing class. She's pregnant, and they're going to a birthing class. And the instructor wore fleece leggings and a purple spaghetti strap top. Some women, she said, hands cupped as if she were holding a beach ball, achieve orgasm during birth. I may have to poke out her third eye, I said to Wood. That totally cracked me up so much. And I don't know, sometimes I think, I'm not going to get into personal history, but it's like birthing instructors sometimes are just like wacky creatures. And it was so funny to me, that part of the book.
I think any woman who's been through these sort of classes has that. You know, if you're, especially women who write, I think you have that sort of deeper analytical Most women have it, and not just writing women, but, you know, that deeper analytical gaze on the world around you, and sometimes it's hard to sit there without thinking, how would I write this?
Right.
And I often found myself doing that during some of those moments. It's I'm one of those people that if things get too serious or if I'm afraid of something, I often have to cope with a sense of humor, so I think that's a coping mechanism for me, perhaps in writing as well.
Yeah, and I thought that your writing did bring a sense of humor along with it, although it wasn't necessarily a funny book, you know, and it wasn't necessarily a book that I'm laughing out loud all the way through, but your characters definitely have their wryness and their interesting moments. I noticed that a lot of your stories are first-person narration. Can you just talk a little bit about that choice?
Yeah, these stories, most of these were written during a two-year period of time, and it was a really, it was a time of radical change for me. So I within 6 weeks in 2009, I gave birth to my first daughter. My husband graduated from veterinary school. His mother, who was also a veterinarian, passed away from cancer, and we put our house in Raleigh, North Carolina, on the market and drove straight up to Vermont with our 6-week-old child, 3 dogs and cat, and moved into the house that we're in now. And, you know, I was really brought to my knees by all of that change, and being away from my parents and sort of managing a colicky infant and this new house, and we were sad, and it was just, there was so much that I felt like my eyes were being opened up to, you know, this sort of, you know, even though I think I was 29 at the time, I felt like I was really jumping into adulthood for the first time. I think there's sort of that purgatory between childhood and adulthood that happens in the 20s, and then suddenly I felt like, wow, there's so many adults I know that carry around the sadness and the suffering, and so many women I know who have been through these challenging times, and they don't talk about them, and I was processing all of that, and so I think the first-person narrative strategy came from sort of my desire to tell a story that I had a sort of autobiographical investment in, and I would say only, you know, only 10% of each protagonist is that, you know, autobiographical element. But I really, that's how I was telling stories to myself at the time, I guess.
Okay, interesting. And you're also, it sounds like you were also stepping into your mother-in-law's home as the woman of the house now. So that's another really big role to take on.
And she was a remarkable woman. She was a veterinarian. She had her pilot's license. She was 6'4" and drove a motorcycle. I mean, she was larger than life.
Wow.
We were, you know, we are still feeling, but it was definitely a period of change. The stuff that writing is born from, certainly.
Yeah, okay. How would you, apart from the first-person narration, which I thought you just did a really nice job of explaining that period of your life, but generally speaking, how would you describe your writing voice and your style of writing?
Yeah, I strive to write cleanly with clarity. I love sentences. I really work hard at getting each sentence right. I want each sentence to be a sort of beautiful thing in its own right and to do work, but never too much work. I never want to pull the reader sort of out of the continuous dream, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always interested in the musicality of the sentences as they fit together. So that's usually what I'm thinking about. And I want to speak directly to a reader. Jim Shepherd, the short story writer, once told me that a story should be told as if you are standing next to someone in a bar, and you turn over, you know, over your shoulder, and you just say, "Hey, let me tell you this story," because that's how I think. There's something engaging when, and an intimacy established when you strip some of the formality down, I think.
Yep.
So that interests me as well. I think when I first started writing, I wanted to be ornate and fancy and serious and imposing and all those things that you think that lots of people associate with great writing, and then I realized what I actually responded to as a reader, or what you just respond to sitting at the dinner table, the qualities of good storytelling. And I think it's just speaking truly and speaking directly. So I would say, I don't know if I've accomplished that in my style, but that's one of the things that I certainly think about.
Yeah. It's funny because you're making those comments reminds me of an aspect of your writing, which is dialogue, which I think you do so beautifully. And I would describe it that same way. Your dialogue seems very realistic, stripped down, not ornate and not a whole lot of embellishments and not even the quotation marks. How do you approach realistic dialogue? Like, how are you listening to people all the time, or are you reading your dialogue out loud and just trying to strip it down? How do you approach that?
Yeah. One of the guiding principles I have with dialogue is trusting your reader. Mm-hmm. So as far as not including, you know, quotation marks or a lot of the early dialogue that I see students write has, you know, a lot of wind-up and hellos and goodbyes. And I think the reader knows so much already that sort of stuff which is taking place, you know, the pleasantries and the orientation and who's speaking. And I think if you've developed your characters well and you have a good narrative going, there's already that trust and understanding, and the dialogue will take on the right life of its own. So I always tell my students that it's so much of making sure you've got the characterizations right, because that's what's going to give the dialogue that whiff of reality and that energy. So that's something I think about when I'm writing dialogue. Yeah. And as far as my actual strategy, I do listen. My husband actually is, when we go to restaurants together, he will sometimes have to turn me away from the most people in the restaurant so that I'll stop listening to their conversations at dinner.
That's funny.
I don't mean to do it. I just do it.
It's just part of who you are. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, you just mentioned, you know, knowing your characters well enough to kind of know where their dialogue's going to go. And you said earlier that you will often think about a story for a long time before you write it. So do you find that most of your character development comes on the page, or do you kind of already know who I don't know if I'm talking about your protagonist or some main character in the story, who that person is to carry you into the writing before you even start?
I do. I mean, and I've certainly had moments of discovery and moments of change while I'm writing. But often I really try to know who they are before I'm writing the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had a good conversation with some students about this recently, you know, on the idea of the death of the author. Nabokov really felt that, you know, the writer's intent was everything, that, you know, the reader should experience it exactly as the writer had meant it to be on the page, and that he didn't believe in this idea of characters taking shape on their own during the writing. You know, he thought that was lazy on the writer's end.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's true of his writing, and I would say it's not so true of mine, although I do try to know the characters well as, you know, before I write, but I certainly reserve the right and allow myself the freedom of understanding what might not be working, or I think, you know, as the tension builds and we see the protagonist moving through the story, really thinking about how they would react or why they are the way they are, what character traits they have, and what unique pressure is on every character. And that's the thing that makes stories rich and makes readers feel, is when you know the pressure on the character. Maybe it's not even something that's being mentioned in the story, but it's financial pressure or aging or, you know, just what are the different things pressing down on that person? And so that's something as I write more and more that I think about with characterization.
There was a character in the title story, Birds of a Lesser Paradise, who I loved so much. And it's the father in the story. I kept reading over the descriptions of him and his perspectives, because I just loved him so much. And I think that what you've just described explains why I loved him so much. He had certain desires and pressures that were, I guess, somehow affecting me most strongly. You know, he is looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker, is that right? The ivory-billed?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his daughter, you know, feels very strongly that this is an extinct bird, but he feels like he saw it once and he will see it again. And he's just a wonderful character. He's got this little miniature golf course in his backyard, and he's clearly somebody who's lived life to the fullest but is aging. So how much did you know about him when you began writing?
You're right. I think there are some characters that I know better than others, and he's one that really was very vivid to me when I sat down to write the story. Just I'm interested in complexity in characters. You know, people are neither fully good nor fully bad. And he was, you know, there was a part of him that was very rough and tumble. You know, he'd grown up in the swamp his entire life. You know, he's a very practical man. He was lonely. He could be a little bit overly honest. You know, he was definitely a practitioner of radical honesty. But then he had this other side that was really romantic about the small town he'd grown up in. And as the town began to sort of die off and people were leaving, he was collecting, you know, some of the abandoned structures. And he was holding out hope for seeing this woodpecker again. And I think that that element of hope and that thing that, that people hold on to is interesting. So I like the balance in that character of those, mm-hmm. those traits.
So, Megan, maybe this would be a good time for you to read from Birds of a Lesser Paradise.
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. This is about 2.5 pages from the title story, Birds of a Lesser Paradise. I fell for Smith the day my father hit his first hole-in-one on his homemade golf course. Dad had spent years shaping the earth in our backyard until he had two holes that landed somewhere between an extravagant mini-golf spread and a Jack Nicklaus par 72. May, my father yelled, hoisting his 9-iron into the air. I did it. He was a couple hundred yards away, and because I didn't think my voice would carry, I jumped up and down a few times and clapped my hands, trying to appear visibly thrilled. But I was self-conscious with Smith standing behind me, his hands stuffed into the pockets of his army green cargo pants, an anxious scowl on his almost beautiful face. Dad sauntered off to pluck the winning ball from the hole, long white beard trailing in the wind, his spaniel Betsy 2 steps behind. It was hardly 50 degrees out, but Dad was wearing shorts and hiking boots. He was nearing 70, but he had the bulging calf muscles of a man half his age. I want to see birds no one else has seen, Smith was saying. I printed out the checklist for North Carolina. How soon can we mark these off? Slow down, I said, smiling. I don't know if I can tell a common golden eye from a loon, he said. Is that important? He followed me to our picnic table, which was soft from rot and green with moss. Smith stuck his fingers into his bramble-thick hair, hair the color of seagrass. It seemed inclined to one side, like a plant reaching for the sun. He wore a paint-flecked T-shirt covered in a school of dolphin fish. First, I said, let me tell you what we can see here in the Great Dismal Swamp. I opened our brochure, pushed it toward him like a menu. We had a chunk of land outside town that had been in my father's family for 2 generations. We lived in his ancestral home and ran Pocosin Birds, our bird-watching business, from the property. In April, I began, birders can expect to see 50 to 100 bird species in the swamp. Are you reading backwards? Smith asked. I have it memorized, I said. I studied his face. His left eye was deep brown, his right hazel. And for a moment, I wondered if he had a glass eye. Eyes like David Bowie, I said, nodding my head in approval. Are you going to take me into the swamp? He asked. He smiled. He was lean and dark from the sun. I couldn't tell if he was 25 or just short of 40, impoverished or on the receiving end of a trust fund. When he smiled, he looked like too much fun to be 30, as if he wasn't tired of the world yet. Typically, I said, we help our clients assemble the correct gear and map, of course. We could drop you off at daybreak. I took a red pen from my pocket and circled an area near Lake Drummond. The best nesting sites for warblers are here, I said. What do you know about songbirds? I want to go in with you, he said. Dad was born on the outskirts of the swamp at a time when it was desolate, hard, and flecked with ramshackle hunting cabins. His father had been into timber, and Dad was raised wild, the kind of man who could pick up a snake by its neck with the confidence I'd exhibit picking up a rubber version in the toy store. He was sentimental about his family home in the town. Anything he was used to having around, he wanted to keep around. So when the town got too small to sustain a post office, he converted the blue mail drops into composting hubs in the back corner of our lot. He bought the abandoned elementary school at auction for almost nothing. No one wanted to pay the taxes on it, and looters had already taken the copper pipes and pedestal sinks. He rented it out for birthday parties, weddings, and to local artists for studio space. When a developer leveled the city park, Dad reassembled the jungle gym in our side yard near the garden and let the scuppernong vines go wild. We lived in a dying town with a dwindling tax base. I never thought I'd come back, but the swamp was in me, and if Dad was half feral, I was one quarter. I liked the way the water tasted, the sound of birds outside my window in the morning. A few years in Raleigh studying conservation biology at the State University, and I needed to find a place where I could look out my window and see nothing man-made. I missed the smell of things rotting, the sun bearing down on a wet log.
Thank you very much for reading that. I'm just going to mention that is Megan Mayhew Bergman reading from Birds of a Lesser Paradise, published by Scribner. So what are scuppernong vines? I've never heard of scuppernong vines.
they're vines in mostly seen in the Deep South, and they're sort of out of fashion, but they grow a sort of, I guess, a kiwi-sized fruit.
Mm.
They're a little polarizing. Not many people love them.
Oh, okay. Well, they make a nice addition to the beginning of the story. And they're fun to say. I love that and maybe this has to do with what you were saying about the changes that were happening in your life at the time that you wrote most of these stories, but I enjoyed that so many of these stories have a theme of mothering and nurturing and people taking care of one another. You know, even in this story, she's mothering her own father, you know, even early in the story before he has some problems arise, you know, she's mothering him with sunscreen and, you know, just taking care of him. And can you talk a little bit? Do you think that that's a theme that will continue to arise in your work as you go forward?
I imagine it will. It was certainly, you know, becoming a mother for the first time as these stories were being written. I know that that was, it was such a radical change for me, just thinking, I think I'd spent, you know, the time in college and just after really thinking about myself. I was really self-involved and hopefully not in a negative way, but just thinking about my career and the things I wanted to do, and I was on my own. And then when becoming a mother, I felt like, God, the universe just cracked open in a way, and I felt so different about my attitude toward people in the world and what I could give people and what I valued in people. And and then the nurturing and mothering instinct became sort of potent.
Yeah.
I have a line elsewhere in the collection where the protagonist is thinking, you know, I want to mother the world, and I sort of had that feeling of just this, all this love that I had to give and wanting to give it. And that definitely permeates this book, and I imagine it will be a theme. I'm always fascinated by the fact that we're still, as humans, members of the animal kingdom. And I thought mothering was such a primal act. And I'm fascinated by that, what my editor called sort of the pull of biology on our modern lives, when we get sort of surprised by these instinctive behaviors that crop up. And so I think mothering is one of them. And I'm always interested in those sort of animal-esque tendencies of humans.
And I would say that a sort of related theme in your work is just the and it is related because, you know, circle of life and everything, but just sort of the strong tie to living a big full life that these characters have. Later in the story you were just reading, you have this line, if I could read it, I loved this. When you camp in the swamp at night, you know there are bears. There are hundreds, and they smell you, and they're curious. Everything sounds large at night, raccoons, squirrels, a startled deer. But nothing was as fierce and wild as me. I was furiously alive. I loved that. But I also loved, I thought it tied in really nicely with what we're just talking about with the mothering and the nurturing. It is all, you know, your character is furiously alive and wanting furiously to take care of her father and to make him happy and well. And anyway.
Thank you. I love that line, and it's very much an intentional aspect of the work at large. So I'm glad that you found it.
Oh, great. Okay. Let's see. Oh, I wanted to talk a little bit about transitions within stories. In the story Saving Face, there's a very scary moment when the convict that you mentioned before, Romulus, who you mentioned is somebody that the reader probably wonders if he can be trusted. And there's this frightening moment where he forces Lila, the woman with the scar, who's the vet, into a shed. And it's very scary. And then you turn the page, and we're in a flashback, and the flashback begins, Lila's darkest moments had occurred when she was alone after the accident. And it was this wonderful transition into, like, I mean, first we want to know what's going to happen in that shed, but we aren't disappointed. We know immediately that we're going to find out something about Lila and what frightens her and how she reacts to that. So anyway, I loved that transition, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that sort of transition in your story.
Yeah, it was a high-stakes move.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
You know, it's not something a writer can do often, or that I think I could have done in more than one story, taking the reader away from the essential action, you know, that of what's about to unfold, because, you know, it provides narrative energy and intrigue to not give the reader what the reader wants immediately, but only so often and so much. And I definitely took a risk there at pausing and slowing down. But I think it made for me, when I go back and read the story, I love the way I read a little faster and with more interest when I'm forced to sort of pause and stop and slow down. And that was the intent there. But I did think through that one, and I didn't get it right the first few times when I tried. That was certainly a story that structurally had to go through some revision.
Yeah, I agree that, in particular because it is a sort of almost semi-violent moment. You're not quite sure if it's going to turn into a violent moment. And he's definitely using his physicality to push her into the shed. So there is this, like, we want to know what happens right away. But I don't know why. It didn't disappoint me to have to wait on that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it gives the reader a moment to imagine. What are we capable of? What is he capable of? What is he going to do? And if we can play worst-case scenario for a few minutes, what ultimately happens is that the reader's expectations are subverted a little. And hopefully that's effective, or hopefully that's why it works.
This question might seem a little... This might be one of those things that you didn't think about at the time that you were working, but I felt like in some of these stories, you provide for your characters proxies for what they most desperately want or need. And for example, you know, you have a character who desperately wants a baby and she has a dog. And so there's a lot in the narrative about this dog and her, you know, her relationship with this dog. And then you have another character who really wants to help and guide her daughter and is unable to do that because of her own limitations at this point in her life. And instead she has the opportunity to save an animal. And is it an I-I? Is that how you say that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not every story, but a few of these stories had these situations where I felt like we learned more about the characters because we got to see how they took care of funneling their desires toward another entity. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's something that I've seen happen in the world and with people I know, and there's something slightly tragic and endearing about it. It's one of those sort of common behavioral things you might see, but relatable, I think, to many of us. And from a technique point of view, from thinking about characterization, it's always important, I think, to know what a character wants, and feeling them want that and move toward that through the story gives the story a certain energy and poignance, I think.
You're so well published. You have such wonderful journals in your history of this book. So I'm wondering if you can give some advice for writers as far as submitting to journals. What was your approach for doing that?
Yeah. First I read them, and I knew sort of, or I began, I didn't know at first, but I began to get a sense of what journals had an aesthetic that matched up with mine. Their concerns or the type of pieces they were publishing. And so I got a sense of where I really wanted to publish. I think at first when you start writing, I know I had this feeling of I would have just been happy for any journal to take a piece of mine, and I was so anxious for that validation that comes with publication. And I got lucky that the Kenyon Review took one of my first stories in an emerging writer contest. And I think it's a piece that probably wouldn't have been picked up by that journal as just a piece for publication, but because it was sort of under a contest or emerging writers, they published it, and I got this wonderful publication credit and experience and what I was looking for. And that was such a nice break for me and gave me some momentum and something to put on my cover letter. And so I really do recommend that as a strategy for kind of first-time writers who are looking for a good publication history or to build that, to looking at some of the great contests that some of these journals offer.
Okay.
And so that was really the turning point for me, was that publication and the Kenyon Review. Otherwise, it's hard, gritty, scrappy work. You know, there were months where I would send out 30 submissions, you know, and get one acceptance, if that. I mean, and going months and months with nothing but rejections and just having to be okay with that. And that was hard for me at first. I used to get so down every time the little rejection slip came in the mail. But then I started to look at it as some sort of evidence of my writing life or my life of letters. And, you know, and as time moved on and my stories got better, I would get you know, notes from the editors, or this was an almost, or send us another piece. And, mm-hmm. you know, eventually that sort of correspondence in the submissions process started to turn into acceptances at a larger rate. And then I developed some great relationships with those journals, Kenyon Review and Plowshares and Oxford American in particular have been really good to my work.
Which are really nice journals to have a relationship with. So that's great.
No complaints.
So it must have been just, you must have just been completely blown away when you were in Best American Short Stories for Housewifely Arts.
Yes, that was a complete surprise. And when I hadn't heard anything about it, and I got the email from the series editor, and I was just astounded. I mean, it came at such a fortuitous time for me, a few months before my book came out. And I was overjoyed. It was a fantastic, huge honor, especially as a short story writer.
Yeah, and what journal was that published in?
Housewifely Arts came out in One Story.
Oh,
which
right.
is
okay.
A journal that publishes one story every 4 weeks in a small volume, and they do it online and they do print copies as well. And they're fantastic. They do so much for the writers they publish. And their editing process was really thorough. It was one of the most thorough editing processes I've ever been through with that story.
Mm. So when you sent them Housewifely Arts, did they accept it with changes, or did they say, look, if you're willing to work with us, we might take this, but we might not?
Yeah, they took it but with the understanding that we were going to edit it.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
So how exciting. I mean, One Story is a wonderful journal to get into. That would be really exciting in and of itself, and then to have it go into Best American Short Stories is awesome.
Those guys, again, have been really good to me. This last weekend, I was just in the city. They do a literary debutante ball every year, and so any of their writers who have published a first book, they support as sort of these literary debutantes, and they present us to Literary Society in New York, and it's a fundraiser for the journal as well, and it was a really nice event. And again, I can't say enough good things about their editors there and the things that they've done for my career.
Okay, I want to just quote another line that I loved in the book. I felt like this line actually had significance for more than just the story in which it presents. The line is, "It occurs to me that sometimes we make homes where we do not belong." I loved that line. And I wondered if that was something that you see as a larger message in your work.
Absolutely. I think I was feeling it on some level for myself, of feeling like I was a lifelong Southerner. I wrote that line in winter in Vermont. I'm not sure. It's quite possible. But also the idea that we often get into trouble when we start living lives that aren't fulfilling us in some way. And you just start to see as you grow older, it's so easy to begin making sacrifices for your children, for your husband, for yourself, and you find that you've gotten so far away from where you want to be, either physically or with your work. And it's just something that I continue to witness either in myself or in others, and I'm sort of fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A number of the stories in the collection have a sadness about them, and yet they're not sad. Overall, they kind of rise above and have more of a sort of strength and hope about them. So if that's not too outside the box of a question, I'm just wondering if you know what I mean and if you can talk about creating that atmosphere in your stories.
I've had a few people say that the book is sad, and I've had some people say that the book is funny, and others say that the book strikes a balance. I hope that it strikes a balance. And as far as creating it technically, I mean, like we were talking about earlier in the interview, it was written during this time in my life where I was incredibly sad, and yet the grief that I was feeling over the loss of my mother-in-law and being away from my own family, and the happiness I was feeling at becoming a mother for the first time, there was sort of this birth-death continuum, and I had never felt so returned to life, to my physical body. You know, I was away from my computer. I was, you know, living on a farm, so I was outside all the time, and this sort of strange vitality that came from really feeling again and really being physically present. And again, I'm really interested in the way that writers can hold on to complex feelings like that, that sort of, while I was sad for those months, I wasn't always sad. Mm-hmm. You know, that there was that texture and change. And I think trying to write the characters in my stories, I wanted, you know, though many of them were going through some difficult things, I wanted their personalities and their coping mechanisms and their complexities to shine through and sort of carry the story. Complete Sadness, I think, is difficult to read on the page. And the same way that I think Complete Beauty or Complete Strangeness is difficult to read on the page. You know, Complete Beauty is sort of like a, I don't know, like a Celine Dion song that maybe gets a little shrill and is too beautiful. You know, that sometimes we need a little strangeness to balance it out, or a little humor to balance out the sadness. But I think readers respond to balance more, and I think that balance is actually truer to life, that there is that texture.
Great. Absolutely. It seems to me, too, that, and maybe this isn't about craft, this is more about life, but I feel like writing does heal us, and it takes us through the growth process or the change process a little faster. And I just wonder if, in a way, you know, writing these stories helped you get past the sadness?
Yeah, writing definitely helped me process a lot of what was going on in my life during that difficult time, and particularly around motherhood. There's nothing I've ever wanted to be better at or understand more than motherhood, and yet I know I will never understand it, and I know I will fail, but working that out on the page certainly interests me, and so I've done a bit of that, and I imagine I will continue to do it.
Yeah. Megan, thank you very much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the book Birds of a Lesser Paradise.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Megan Mayhew Bergman. You can read more about her work at her blog site, mayhewbergman.com. Today's Rate the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Megan Mayhew Bergman. Twice during our conversation, she talked about the benefits of slowing down the fiction narrative to its benefit. First, she mentioned slowing things down, in an almost poetic sense, as you approach the end of a story. She likes to think about slowing things down, almost like a poem, as she comes to the end of her stories. And then she also talked about slowing down the outcome of a suspenseful moment in a story, such as that moment that she talked about where she actually switched to another scene, a kind of flashback scene, right when the action might have otherwise gone a different way. So this week, think about how you might use this advice in a story or a scene of your own. Slow things down, perhaps, when you're most tempted to speed things up, and see what happens. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page, and if you are a Facebook user, please like us on the Write the Book radio show page. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. Always, if you have comments about the show, please feel free to email me. You can also send news about book-related events, and you can send writing prompts to suggest, and I will credit you if I use one of your prompts. So please send any of these things to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that The Radiator is an all-volunteer community station. It's here thanks to community support and involvement. And you can find out more information about The Radiator and its mission and how to get involved online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.
Thank you.